Hey, John.
Hey George, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm great. I am speaking to you from my new apartment in Hoboken, New Jersey.
Wow. So you're
Yep.
much closer to Stevens Institute now, where you work.
I am so close that it's kind of freaky. I was describing, so a friend of mine at Stevens was asking me what it was like to be in this apartment building. And I said it was almost like a fundamental law of nature has been suspended, like gravity or something, because instead of this extremely long, arduous commute from Cold Spring to Hoboken, now it literally takes me 3 or 4 minutes to walk from my apartment into my office.
Wow.
It's just, I mean, all of my time is completely restructured, and in some ways it's exhilarating, in other ways it's a little disconcerting because I have so much free time. I don't have any excuses, all my usual excuses, for not accomplishing things.
Yeah, you can't get stuck on tr in traffic coming down from the Hudson Valley. Oh, that must be nice though, not having to do that drive.
Yeah, the drive, and well, I usually took the train, but it was
Oh.
Metro North, that train that derailed recently,
Oh yeah.
and then the shuttle, and then like the Q train, and then the PATH train, and then
Oh, so you'd have to take Metro North to Grand Central?
and then go
Oh, and then take the path and then take the Q train to the PATH train?
after taking the shuttle across town. I mean, it was just crazy.
Wow. Yeah, this is yeah, that's crazy.
I've been thinking of doing this for a while, and my kids at least sort of have left home to go to college.
Oh yeah, so it was a good time to, or there was less compelling reason to be there. Well, that sounds nice. You mentioned that you have a magnificent view, right?
I have a great view. So let me see. Now, if people can see over my shoulder, they'll see just across a courtyard toward the other side of my apartment building. But actually, if you go up to those sliding glass doors and just look a little bit left, you see across the Hudson River to the New York City
Wow.
skyline. It's just an
Oh,
amazing,
that's great.
it's a really grand view that I have
Ah,
not gotten,
nice.
I haven't gotten used to it yet, and I don't think I ever will. But what I can show people, hold on a second. My new pride and joy, where is it? Can I get it in the picture here? That my so I you know because I lived in a furnished apartment owned by a nun in my last place at
Oh,
Cold
right.
Spring. I had to buy everything. I didn't have a chair. I didn't have dishes or silverware or anything. For some reason, I can't get in here. Anyway, so the thing that I was most looking forward to buying was a humongous TV, a big flat screen TV.
Oh.
And so I bought myself a 60-inch television.
5 feet in diagonal.
Yeah.
That sounds, I don't
I know.
know.
It's wretched excess, George, but as a humble science
Oh.
writer, I think I'm entitled to a little tiny bit of wretched excess.
Oh yeah, why not? But I find them just kind of overwhelming and oppressive. Like if I'm staying at a hotel and they have like usually they have like maybe a 40 or 40 48 inch like LG flat panel thing. I turn it on and the people just all look so huge. I just find it really discombobulating.
Well, it can be disconcerting depending on what you're watching. So I was watching, I'm a football fan, so I was watching some football game. One of the teams was the Dallas Cowboys, and at the halftime, they had an interview with the wife of the owner of the Dallas Cowboys. His name is Jerry Jones, and his wife
Yeah.
is a big socialite in Texas, and they had this close-up of her face, and I must say it was kind of scary. I mean, her face looks so artificial
Yeah.
that
Yeah, high def's not always good for close-ups on faces.
yeah, I know I have read somewhere that the advent of high def TV, especially these big screen TVs, led the pornography industry to invest more in body makeup because supposedly the porn stars, when you could see the details of their skin, that it was not that flattering.
Well, so. Yeah, I'm sure. Right. There's something too about just having these big looming people on the wall, and I'm still used to. I got a high def screen, but it's only like 20-21 inches in diameter, so I have to sit much closer.
Yeah, you know, I think maybe the implication, I know what you mean about you walk into a room and there's a huge TV, and it's almost like the implication is this, what is represented on this screen is more important than your pathetic, boring little life.
Yeah, which could well be true.
Yes, right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of stuff gets represented on that screen, including some very important things.
Yeah, I've just kind of...
Well, anyway, it sounds like a nice splurge, and this apartment sounds great.
Yeah, I'm digging it.
It sounds a little cavernous. Are you still putting in furniture and rugs and things?
No rugs, just a bare floor at this point. I haven't put up pictures or anything. As I said, you know, yeah. I got a couch and a big TV, and you know, that's pretty much all I need for now. But
I can hear your voice kind of ricocheting off the walls.
Yeah, that's right. It's like a little basketball court in here.
So what have you been up to?
Well, I was going to ask you.
Science-wise.
I don't know. You tell me. I know you've been up to a lot. So let's start with you. You've got, you know, your book came out.
I don't know if we've talked since my book officially came out. I mean, we talked about it a few times before that.
I just Googled us. And as far as I could tell, our last chat was in August.
Oh, okay. That was just before. Yeah, the book officially came out right at the end of August, August 28th. So essentially a September book. So, yeah, you know, that was exciting. A lot of really, really great reviews right out of the, you know, right from the start, which I don't think I've ever had so much luck in getting a lot of really good reviews right off the bat like that, instead of, you know, usually you wait and you wait and then they come in kind of as a trickle. But so that was really nice. And then, you know, now 3 months has passed and it's the point where, you know, just kind of coasting along and you realize you have to do something else.
Uh-huh. And
but, you know, and I got a lot of the, you know, it looks like I've been more productive than I really have because of some of the stuff I did was serial rights excerpts from the book, like in Scientific American and Discover and Unwired. And one of the stranger things that happened is that, do you know the paper, The Daily Mail in London?
Yeah.
They bought the serial rights to the book in the UK.
Uh-huh.
You know, the Daily Mail is like this, I think it's the second largest circulation newspaper in the world, but that's because it's basically this really cheesy tabloid.
Uh-huh.
And I just kept thinking, I mean, why do they want to do this?
Eyeballs are eyeballs, George.
Yeah, no, I was really apprehensive. And then especially when, at some point the publicity, serial rights person at the London publisher told me, "Oh, I just wanted to give you a heads up. They do serial rights a little differently at the Mail." And I said, "Oh, well, how is that?" They said, "Well, don't be surprised if it's not actually your own words."
That's good.
That appear. So they kind of paraphrase you in more Daily Mail-y kind of language, mixed in with your own language, and then they put your byline on it.
And they said,
but by contract, we insist that they let us see it in advance, but it'll be very, like, suddenly they'll just say they're running it, and you'll have, like, a few hours to read it and approve it, and you always have the option of removing your byline from it,
uh-huh.
Which just kind of defeats the point. But actually, it came in, and it was, you know, and it was actually fine. It was, you know, this real... It wasn't me writing. It was very simplified and I hated the lead, but they let me rewrite the lead, and I just thought, well, I guess anyone who reads the Daily Mail, they either know that this is how they do it, or B, it's going to, introduce my book to a whole different crowd of people, Daily Mail readers, as opposed to, say, Times of London readers. Mm-hmm. And that might be good. But then again, they might get the book and find out that it's not what they were expecting. But anyway, I ask, you remember our friend Michael Brooks?
Yeah.
Our London science journalist friend. So I sent an email to Michael and asked him, isn't this a little kind of a, lowbrow paper? And his reply was, well, yes, everybody, likes to complain about it, but any of us would kill to get our books excerpted in the Daily Mail. So I did it. I can't tell that it made much difference, but that was probably the single weirdest thing that happened.
I'm just curious, how did they sex you up, if they did sex you up?
Oh, God. I mean, I just read it really quickly. I mean, they it was basically, mostly what they did was, the way the book is written, I have this back narrative, which is the story of my ex-wife, Nancy.
Yeah.
And that terrible experience she had with the stage 4 metastatic cancer. And mm-hmm. I use that narrative as kind of a backbone just to hold together sort of an exploration of the science of cancer and try to come out at the end with like an overview for a general reader, which includes me. I'm not an expert in cancer, but of what scientists know and what they don't know about the subject of cancer. And in doing that, kind of exploding a lot of things that people think are true about cancer, but that either aren't or there's very shaky evidence that they might be. So they basically concentrated on extracting the story of Nancy.
Yeah.
And then maybe dramatizing that a little more than I did, because I wanted that story to be more of a low key kind of thing that sort of hovers in the background as this constant reminder that, because you start reading, or when I was writing the book, and hopefully when people are reading it, you get this sense of what an intellectually fascinating phenomenon cancer is.
Yeah.
And then you get so far out into the stratosphere of thinking what a fascinating, all these, the science, you need to be pulled back down to earth and be, reminded of, just the horror this causes.
Yeah. Because I would think, tabloids, their way of covering cancer ordinarily would be to talk about cures, breakthroughs,
yeah,
and so forth. And that's about the furthest thing in the world from your message.
Oh yeah, right. It's just almost the opposite. That there's a threshold amount of cancer that's always been there. It always will be there, and there's no such thing as winning the war on cancer. I mean, the best you can do is hold the line against what's basically this fundamental trade-off in evolution of granting cells enough autonomy to be able to evolve, or evolving enough autonomy as they evolve into these complex creatures like us. But so they're given all this autonomy by evolution, and yet that's a trade-off, because if the safeguards break down in this intricate network of little signaling and cross-signaling, you might have a cell start evolving on its own within the ecosystem of your body and turning into this little quasi-creature we call a cancer.
I know that we've talked about this before, but since I've done a couple of posts on it, I'd like you to remind me what you think about the value of mammograms.
Mm.
So they've been in the news a lot lately because there's an ABC reporter. She's on the show Good Morning America. Amy Roback, who,
oh, right,
to promote the value of mammograms, had an on-air mammogram back in October, and then to her horror, it turned out that she had it detected cancer in her, and so then she elected in this very public way to get a double mastectomy, and she has she's been back in the news repeatedly. There was just a cover story in People magazine about her. And so I did a couple of posts.
Yeah, I saw those.
This. Yeah, so
she had the BRAC mutations, which gives you a is that right?
I have not read that. That she had a genetic predisposition to breast cancer.
It wasn't like the Angelina Jolie.
No, I haven't. I've just been looking at mass media coverage, and then some of the commentary by experts on cancer testing, especially this guy Gilbert Welch, who has done a lot of research on the value of tests for breast cancer and prostate cancer and other cancers, and thinks that tests are overused.
Yeah. It seems like the fundamental problem is, you know, one is what they seem to be really good at, especially as the mammograms get more and more acute, as the equipment gets more and more refined. They're very good at finding these so-called in situ ductal carcinomas, mm-hmm. which are described as stage zero, which a lot of, you know, there was recently some articles about, I think it was in the Times and other places, where a lot of oncologists were saying we shouldn't even be calling these cancer because it's giving people an inflated idea. And you know, throughout your body, there's going to be these little aplasias or cells that are, you know, mutated to some degree, and some of them to the extent where they're replicating slightly more faster than their neighbors. But you know, they're going to smolder along for decades, Before we had such accurate, precise mammograms, many people, you know, many women went through their lives and died of something else without ever knowing that they had these. So there's the danger that you catch those and then overtreat them.
Right.
Of course, there's problems with overtreatment. And on the flip side of it is that the really horrible, aggressive cancers, you know, the kind that just spread so quickly that before you know it, it's, you know, metastasized to other parts of your body, those move so fastly that you could get a mammogram, you know, in January, and then, you know, weeks later, it could be, you know, you could have a cancer that's already just like developing to a very advanced stage and will soon be colonizing other parts of your body. So you don't catch those really nasty ones unless you're really, really lucky. But, it's a tough one, but you know, if you have like a family disposition to this, and something like the BRCA mutations that very much increases the likelihood, it's a different decision from someone just routinely getting one at say the age 40 or the age 50, as opposed to say 60 or 70. So,
what makes this decision difficult, or maybe not so difficult, for many women and physicians, is that it's a little bit apples and oranges what you're trying to the two options that you're trying to weigh. So there are some women whose lives are definitely saved by having mammograms.
Yeah.
They detect a tumor, they detect a cancer, and they get early intervention, or earlier intervention that can help save them, or you know, means that they're not going to die of that cancer, at least not as soon as they would have if they had not gotten the test at all. On the other hand...
Yeah, if you can get a breast cancer when it's stage one or two, your chances are just, you know, vastly greater of successful treatment. And if it's, you don't catch it till stage four, it's almost always fatal.
Okay, but here's where it gets complicated. First of all, depending on various assumptions that you make about the efficacy of treatments and so forth, about one woman in more than 1,000 has her life saved after getting regular mammograms over, say, a 20-year period, one in 2,000. Meanwhile, there are anywhere from 3 to 10 times more women who are getting unnecessary treatment. That means chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery as a result of those tests.
Right.
So the options are women, the risks and benefits that women are weighing are, yes, you might, there is some chance that you will have your life saved by having this test. But it's quite small, and that chance is outweighed by the much greater probability that you will get unnecessary treatment. And I realize that women are weighing, okay, chance of death versus chance of just, you know, the hassle of chemo and radiation and surgery and so forth. And they just say, you know, I don't want to die. And so even if the odds are much smaller that my life will be saved by this test. That's
right. It's worth the risk, even though chances are you'll be treated or treated unnecessarily. Yeah, I mean, but then radiation and chemo are just such, and you know, of course they have come with all kinds of side effects, and some long lasting and some lifetime side effects, and sometimes not, and surgery as well. And then, of course, then if you don't do that and you think, well, this is probably one of those ones that didn't need to be treated, and you don't treat it, and then it does turn out to blossom into a, you know, higher stage tumor, you know, then you're really, really feeling this deep regret. And with prostate cancer, I think it's even maybe in some ways it's an even more stark choice, because the tests are, you know, the PSA test, the protein specific antigen blood test that may or may not show that you have a predisposition to or that you're developing a prostate cancer, that has so many false positives.
Right.
And in that case, so many, you know, there's some statistic, like they did autopsies of men over 70 years old, and something like 70% of them had prostate cancer that they didn't know about because they died of something else,
right.
You know, cardiac or another cancer, maybe unrelated. So that, you know, there's, and then the treatment for that, you know, can, you know, leave a man incontinent and impotent and just, you know, huge downsides, and it's even less likely, I think, that you will have caught a cancer that actually needed to be treated. But you know, I don't actually know if they've been able to compare the numbers and seeing if it's more or less likely than with in situ breast cancer, but
they have.
Either way, it's a horrible choice. But I guess what I ultimately came to me and sort of decided was that the screening, the kind of screening for cancer that's worth it, is the ones where there's an intervention that we know have good evidence works, and that it's very low risk. And the example would be a colonoscopy, because, you know, if you get a colonoscopy the radiologist or whoever does those sees a polyp, you know, a polyp is, you know, a little clump of aplasic cells that's starting to, you know, divide, you know, a little bit abnormally, and you can just snip them out during the scanning procedure with these little built-in remote tools and remove this thing that possibly could have or possibly not could have blossomed into a tumor. But the downsides are very, very low, you know, the risks of being injured by a colonoscopy. I mean, they exist, but they're so low, and the benefits of early treatment there, I think, can be so high that to me seems like an obvious one to do.
Yeah. First of all, in terms of comparing mammograms and the prostate cancer tests, the odds are much greater in the case of positive prostate cancer tests, especially the PSA tests, that you will get a false positive or unnecessary treatment. It's about 30 to 1.
Okay, good. You have the numbers. I that was my gut feeling, but I didn't want to say that without having the numbers in front of me.
Yeah, there. So, I mean, the I've written about that as well. The one of the guys who invented the PSA test has said that he now regrets it and thinks that it's actually been detrimental to men's health, because the risks and benefits are so lopsided.
And the way that it's marketed is just. I had some examples in my book. There was one that I saw in a talk that was given by Gary Schwitzer, who runs that really good health media kind of criticism site, mm-hmm. Where he analyzes reports on health media, kind of what Paul Rayburn is doing with Science in General at the Night Tracker. But he gave this talk, and he had an example that he attributed to Ivan Oransky, I think. I gave him the photo, and it was at sports stadiums. They have billboards, so the men can see them from the stands with urologists, soliciting business, and they say things like striking out at the urinal, time to come in for your prostate exam. And then one of these advertisements was actually in one of the little soap pads that go in the bottoms of the urinals in the men's room at the sports stadium. Mm-hmm. So they would stare down at the soap pad, but had this message from a local urologist, and then you could go in and get your PSA test, and if it, for some random reason or for some causal reason, came up positive, you might be going down the rabbit hole to all this very likely unnecessary treatment and very lucrative for the urologist.
It's funny, the National Football League has been promoting the hell out of mammograms.
And why is that?
It's hard to say. There's this gigantic foundation, the Komen Foundation. That it very aggressively promotes mammograms and has a lot of celebrity endorsers and so forth. And, I'm sure overall they are very well-intentioned. They have programs to promote mammograms to low-income women for free.
Yeah.
But they're not candid about some of these risks and benefits. They make it sound so, and this is true of Amy Robach as well, that this is a life-saving procedure, when actually the odds are that will not be a life-saving procedure.
They really, really seriously overhype it.
Yeah. All right, so we've talked about this a lot before. I know you've written some great articles for National Geographic.
That was the other reason that gave the illusion that I've been so productive, is the two stories that I've been working on and off for years, and a lot of that time they were just kind of making their way through the editorial pipeline, like the mouse swallowed by the snake. Finally, coincidentally, they both converged and appeared in this month's issue of National Geographic.
All right.
Which is kind of a fun coincidence. So, one of them was about this trip I took to India that we probably talked about it more than 2 years ago when I actually did the trip to write about this archaeological site where they're using these high-speed laser scanners to create like 3D virtual holodeck-like simulations of endangered cultural monuments, in this case an 11th century Hindu temple. Mm-hmm. And then the other story was actually an essay about my fight against tumbleweeds.
Which
one? Two very different subjects.
Yeah, which one do you want to talk about first? Get India archaeology, it might be similar to something that some folks at Stevens are doing. So we've got a guy who's he's a professor in the art department who does digital photography, and he gave a presentation recently based on a trip that he took to Turkey, I think it was, and he went into these ruins of really ancient religious dwellings. I think these are churches or chapels that date back to the, 3rd or 4th century, something like that. And and he set up these extremely high resolution cameras and took pictures in the inside and outside, and then you could kind of take a virtual tour through the structure.
Okay, yeah, this sounds like the very same technology.
Mm-hmm.
And they, in this case, they started out with, they had three kinds of scanners, and the highest resolution one would basically, okay, I should back up and say the way these things work is they bounce a laser beam, you know, they shoot it out against the wall, and then it ricochets off the wall and comes back. Mm-hmm. And then the camera times the delay. So the delay gives you the distance. And so if there's a distance of, say, a few millimeters, it will pick up that little feature in the wall. So in this case, it was like these intricate carvings of Vishnu and other Hindu deities and Hindu mythological figures, and just this vast, you know, walls of these things. And then there's so first they do kind of a rough and ready scan, and then they do a scan that's like accurate within a few millimeters, about a quarter of an inch, to get a higher resolution. Mm-hmm. And then they finally take photographs, very high resolution digital photographs, and then they use this computer software to combine these all. You know, they have a frame, and then they put up the sides, like the veneer, and then on the veneer, they put the wallpaper of the photograph. So you get this photorealistic three-dimensional simulation, and if you can, you know, go through with like 3D glasses, and if something like the holodeck existed, you could project it on the holodeck and actually walk through it. But it's quite amazing.
That is so cool. So this means that you have one expedition to some of these sites, and then they create this file. This is something I assume could be put, let's say, on a website. And then,
yeah, right.
And then other scientists can study this thing as though they were right there.
Yeah, right. And then in time too. So let's say centuries pass by and the simulation still exists, and they can see, you know, if the site's been damaged, or just compare how much it's been worn down by erosion. Mm-hmm. The rubric that I coined for this was preservation in cyberspace.
Nice.
and you can see some of this on the web. There are two sites. There's an organization in California called CIARC, CIARK, which is they say it's short for Cybernetic Archives, but I like Cybernetic Ark because it's like the Ark. Noah's Ark being used to save these monuments by digitizing them. Mm-hmm. And then the other group, which is affiliated with this, is called the Scottish 10, based in Glasgow. And they're called that because they had a goal of scanning 10 World Heritage cultural sites during the next 5 years. So this was one of the, it's on the nomination list for the World Cultural Heritage sites, this temple called Rani Ki Vav in the state of Gujarat in India. So they're the ones I wrote about. I went out there, and it took them 2 weeks to do the scanning. You know, they have to set up these cameras on tripods, move them to different levels, and use scaffolding to lower the cameras in places that are inaccessible. And I was there for like 1 week of that, just kind of hanging out and watching them and taking notes.
Oh, God.
It's really interesting.
You've got a great life, George. who's funding this? Was this a National Geographic project?
This is a National the project itself?
Yeah.
Oh, they get grants. Scottish 10 gets grants from a lot of organizations. I think, yeah, I mean, one of them is, it's called Historic Scotland Foundation, or... Mm-hmm. Well, that actually might be a government entity in Scotland. I'm not sure, but they had a lot to do with it. And it's not a National Geographic project. Uh-huh. So, I mean, of course, I was funded by my National Geo to go out there and write about it. But that was pretty cool.
It sounds like something that Google Maps might be interested in. You know, I keep reading more about this army of Google
people that
are going around and creating photographic, very high resolution photographic representations of, I think I just saw a story about a team of Google people going down the Grand Canyon and you know, having cameras mounted on their heads and they're sort of recording
Oh,
everything
wow. Scanning the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, so that then you can use Google Maps to descend into the Grand Canyon and look around and get a sense of what it's like actually to be there. So why not? I mean, Google could use its pocket change,
right,
to have sort of micro versions of that and examining.
Yeah, because this would be smaller, but I mean, not as big as the Grand Canyon, but much higher resolution, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, with something like Rani Kivav, it struck me as it's kind of like a canyon. It's like, you know, you walk along the ground and suddenly this thing opens up in front of you, and it's like 100 feet deep and like stepped, kind of these huge steps that go down to a well in the ground. And then all of this was originally a stone temple that had different, like half a dozen different floors and these ornate columns and just like every surface just intricately carved with this Hindu artwork. And yeah, you could be like zooming with Google Maps, and you go a little north of Ahmedabad and in the state of Gujarat, and then you're the town of Pathan, and then you see the little thing saying Rani Ki Vav, and then you could descend, and you could actually go down and around these little columns and you know, see Ganesh, the elephant trunk god, looking at you. And get to the bottom of the well and look up, and then you see all these little carvings of Shiva that are, you know, up and down the inside of this well. It's it would be very cool. They must be, you know, talking to.
I would
to
think
Google.
So. Once again, yeah. I think virtual reality is overtaking, I don't know, plain old reality or whatever whatever it is that we call this place where we live.
Yeah, you can't, no matter how good it is, you can't beat the resolution of real reality.
Yeah, so you can't beat the experience that you had actually being in that site as a reporter.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right.
Even though, of course, it's distorted by the imperfections of memory. But
yeah. Okay, so what is it about tumbleweeds that we should
know? Oh, well, think about tumbleweeds. I mean, I started battling them, you know, several years ago while I was still married, and it was actually after, partly in celebration of my wife successfully finishing her cancer treatment. I should have mentioned before that she recently passed the 10-year anniversary of a stage 4 metastatic cancer.
Wow.
And it's remained in remission, and she's very, very healthy. And
that's great.
It is, yeah. So our marriage didn't last, but she certainly is doing well. Mm-hmm. But we had bought this land west of town, like 2.5 acres for her to keep a couple of horses on, because she'd been boarding them out and then realized that and this perfect place came up for sale. And it was like many places on the outskirts of Santa Fe and throughout the West, it was infested with tumbleweeds, mm-hmm. which the Latin name for this particular variety, and the most common one, I think, is Salsola tragus. And every spring, you see these things, and they start sprouting in the hillsides, and they look like these beautiful little blue-green stars. And you think at first, you know, there's some kind of nice native plant coming up, or maybe have a nice ground cover. And then they quickly transmogrify into these horrible little things with these spiny purple vein green fingers, and then they grow at this incredible rate. So it just almost seems like you can, you know, you'll pull one up and then you'll miss the one next to it, and you'll come back the next day and that one's twice as big. And it's not quite that fast, but that's how it seems. They just seem to be burgeoning around your eyes. And we decided to try to, you know, we knew we couldn't get rid of them entirely because, you know, they blow in from other land too. But so for, you know, the whole season as they came out, you know, every weekend at least, we'd canvass the entire property, every square foot, pull up all of the little ones while they were growing to get them before they went to seed, and then put them in big black plastic garbage bags, and then I'd haul them to the landfill. Mm-hmm. And and then do, and then again the next week, and you'd come back, and there'd be just as many more new ones growing, and you did this again and again. And then the next spring, I got out there with a weed torch, you know. So, as soon as I saw them, by now I could recognize them when they were just like, quarter of an inch high, peeking out of the ground. Oh, a weed torch is great. It's like a blowtorch on a stick, and then so. You burn these things, and it's so satisfying. And then I also used an herbicide called triclopyr. It's almost like it induces something like cancer in the weeds. It causes some of the cells in what's called the meristem of the plant to start growing out of control, and the plant becomes kind of weird and twisted, and then dies. Also very satisfying.
George, it's obvious that you take great pleasure in your combat with the tumbleweeds.
Yeah, I lost. The next spring came and they were as bad as ever. So I used that as the story here, and then I found out all kinds of amazing things about tumbleweeds, like the fact that it's and a lot of people probably know this, but we take them as this icon of the American West, the tumbling tumbleweed, and Gene Autry singing about them, and they actually come from Siberia.
Is that right?
Yeah, like a lot of weeds that have done really well throughout the world, they're like Eurasian invaders, and it's just like a few seeds came over on the sock of some Ukrainian immigrant, and the actual official story is that contaminated flax seeds that were imported by Ukrainian immigrants in South Dakota. And the amazing thing is they have a ground zero for the invasion. So this is like in the 1870s, and it was traced to this one farm near this little town called Scotland, South Dakota. Mm-hmm. So, and I found all these great historic documents. So like around the 1890s, it was getting so bad that these farmers were sending letters to Washington, to the Department of Agriculture, saying, that there was these horrible, weird plants, that were invading them and crowding out everything and tumbling and rolling and spreading their seeds. Like one tumbleweed can like roll for miles and distribute a quarter of a million seeds.
Oh my God.
And these things can get the size of Volkswagen bugs.
The cleverness of it. It's just,
yeah.
I mean, some of the most rapacious organisms are the most admirable in terms of their ingenuity.
Yeah.
There must be lots of example of rolling, of plants that roll, that are uprooted and roll to distribute their seeds, but.
This is probably the best engineered by evolution, I rush to add. But,
right.
I mean, it puts almost all of its energy into making seeds in these very spindly little stalks that just have, just enough little green on them to get enough energy from photosynthesis. And there's a lot of air in between the tumbleweeds. And they form, pretty close to perfect little, quasi-spherical kind of objects. And then they have these little cells in the stem that, just like the cells in an apple stem, when it comes fall, they weaken. So just, weakens so the apple falls from the tree, weakens so the first gust of wind starts blowing the dead tumbleweed. And it's just amazing. So they spread from South Dakota within a few years to all the surrounding states. And by 1895, they'd reached California. And now they're in every state. Yeah, every state of the United States except Florida and I think Alaska.
Really?
They do have them in Hawaii.
So Connecticut has tumbleweeds where I grew
up? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you probably don't have very many of them. I mean, because wherever land is well cultivated and taken care of, they don't compete that well against well-watered crops. Where they do really well in neglected areas, mm-hmm. that don't get a lot of water because they don't require that much water themselves, and they have these really extensive taproot systems that they can like collect water from a large area around them, mm-hmm. and And oh, and it's just, yeah, and then they just put out, you know, as I mentioned, you know, tens of thousands, as many as 250,000 seeds for one large tumbleweed. And these things remain viable in the soil for years.
So, you've dealt a serious blow to another little bit of American iconography.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, maybe my wife's kept up with it and it's better now, but yeah. But, you know, it's just the kind of thing where you'd see one out of the corner of your eye. It was like it was hiding under this rock, just crouching. And then they seemed to evolve before my eyes. Like, you know, like later in the season, they would just get like, you know, 2 inches big and they'd immediately start making seeds. It's like they, you know, they were going to go to seed before I managed to find them and pull them up. And
you know, this reminds me for some reason of this battle that lasted for many, many years between my my ex-wife Susie and squirrels. So Susie used to, you know, she loves birds, and so she surrounded our house with bird feeders and the squirrels, you know, so she had conventional bird feeders, and the squirrels very quickly figured out how to get into the feeder and steal the seeds. And so mm-hmm. Susie kept inventing more and more elaborate countermeasures, all of which invariably were defeated by the squirrels. I mean, all of them. And there were some that seemed so impossible. So the one that most amazed me that the squirrels defeated was she strung a feeder on a wire that hung between two trees that were about, I don't know, 20 feet apart, and you know, a very thin wire, and the problem is she realized after, and she was so, what was funny is that she would be so triumphant every time, okay, this is it, I have defeated the squirrels once and for all, and then you know, she'd be looking out there and she'd notice that the seeds were vanishing really, you know, faster than the birds could have been eating them. So she'd think, could it be? Have the squirrels found a way around this design? And then one day I looked out there and I saw a squirrel. It was inching its way upside down across the wire. You know what I mean? Kind of hanging onto the wire and going hand over paw, whatever you call
Whoa.
It.
That's amazing.
Out to the bird feeder.
God.
And this would make Susie hate the squirrels even more, and it filled me, it's kind of like the tumbleweeds, I was filled with admiration for the athleticism and determination yes. and ingenuity of the squirrels. Really,
yeah.
Really
yeah.
phenomenal.
Yeah. There's a part of you that has to sort of grudgingly admire it.
Yes.
Although I think it may have gone too far. I mentioned in my article how appalled I was when I found out there was a company that's in Oklahoma, I think. Anyway, it's in my article, but they sell tumbleweeds. So you can buy one for like $15 in a box as like a novelty gift or something. And they apparently have a big business in Japan.
Oh, God.
And they also sell tumbleweeds for use on like movie sets. Or I guess Ralph Lauren bought a bunch of them to use with window displays at Bloomingdale's or something for like, you know, the look of the West.
It's like selling rabies inoculation kits.
Exactly. It's just disgusting. In Albuquerque, my hometown, just 60 miles south of me, every Christmas they put up a tumbleweed snowman. This huge, menacing, huge, giant tumbleweed snowman looms over Interstate 40, looking very evil to me, but apparently not to others.
That is truly bizarre.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, do you want to talk about... I've been reading your series on Murray Gell-Mann. I know we've talked
yeah,
about.
Yeah, I was really yeah. Thanks for mentioning that on CrossCheck, and then it gave me a chance to reread that great profile you'd done of Murray back in the early '90s in Scientific American.
Yeah, well, if you're talking about the thing I just posted,
Oh, you posted for the one from the book.
Yeah,
right?
And it actually was a little different. So, you know, I wrote a profile of him for Scientific American, came out in 1991, and it was more an overview. It was it wasn't so much about complexity. It was more an overview of his career.
Yeah.
And it actually got into some of the stuff that you talked about, which is this sort of weird ambivalence that he had about his quirk theory initially, where he said, I mean, this is how I remembered him. This is how I remembered how I put it together from talking to him and reading about it, and also reading what you wrote about him, that he sort of said, yeah, I've got this theory, and I'm not sure if I even take it that seriously, but it solves some of the problems we're having with all these strange things coming out of the accelerators. And he wasn't necessarily, he kind of had deniability built into it. So if it turned out that it was wrong, then he'd be covered. But then when it was discovered, and then some people said, well, even Murray Gell-Mann didn't think it would be real. He said, what are you talking about? Of course I knew they would be real.
Yeah. Yeah. He was really mad that I came out, you know, on, differently in the book, because it was just so obvious to me from looking at the old historic documents and even seeing like a film of him giving a lecture at Caltech, he sort of looked very askance at the idea that there were these little things called quarks with fractional charges, you know, since we never observed them in the world. And he referred to them as imaginary quarks and as mathematical quarks and as a convenient a calculating device. But at the same time, he also was considering the possibility that there was some way in which they only would manifest themselves at super high energies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what finally came out was this idea of quark confinement in, you know, quantum chromodynamics is the theory of the strong nuclear forces and like three quarks combined to make a proton. And the quarks are held together by gluons, called that for obvious reasons. And they're held by the strong force, and the strong force is such that, you know, the further apart you pull a quark from another quark, the stronger the tug gets between them. So until it becomes infinite. So the quarks are permanently trapped or confined inside the protons and neutrons and mesons, so you can never see them. So now, you know, he was kind of saying, well, that's what I meant, you know, that they, you know, they weren't going to be like, you know, independent freestanding quarks, or you weren't going to have like a quarkonics industry like with electronics that you can free the electrons.
Uh-huh.
But you go back and you see that, you know, he was as confused and ambiguous about it as anyone else. And it just seemed odd to me that, well, that didn't seem odd to me. I mean, it was a really strange theory, and it's amazing that, you know, it turned out to be true, and they came up with this explanation. But what amazed me was how adamant he was later that he had believed in the reality of quarks all along in this very, very specific way. And it was like it wasn't enough that he had made one of the great discoveries of the 20th century, but he felt that somehow detracted from it. But I'm sure he still holds that position to this day, and he thinks that I just misunderstood everything.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that he's taking it out on you, but there are many other people, historians of science and other physicists, who have the same view of his early attitude toward quarks.
Oh, yeah, and I interviewed them all. Or many of them. And just the most telling thing was finding things like going beyond the papers like published in Physical Review and finding the transcript of like one of those physics summer schools that they have in Erici, Sicily,
mm-hmm.
and seeing some comments that, you know, were made there during discussion and more off the cuff and informal, and, you know, everyone was struggling over this idea.
Yeah, you know, I realized, so I just went back over, so I, you know, I posted this excerpt from The End of Science on Gell-Mann today, because I was inspired by reading your pieces about him, and it was funny, you know, the theme that came out of my second interview with him, which was at the Santa Fe Institute in 1995 was that he was surprisingly critical and filled with doubts about the agenda of the field of complexity. So the really ambitious mm-hmm. complexity theorists hope that they would discover something really profound that would be just as important as quantum mechanics or relativity, quark theory, the double helix.
Oh, yeah. Evolution. They called it like a fourth law of thermodynamics.
Yeah, you know, a self-organizing principle of the universe.
Yeah.
And Gell-Mann was you know, he basically said that's not going to happen. And that he thought that physics already explained plenty. And then on top of that, you just had kind of history and contingency and all these other contextual factors that could explain biology and so forth. And he thought the only real chance, you know, we talked about the limits of science, and he thought the only real chance for a fundamental advance would come from particle physics and in the direction of a unified theory. And he was very keen on string theory and still is keen on it. And I suppose it's because the success of quark theory was so extraordinary, because it was something that seemed entirely abstract and mathematical and really, it violated common sense, you know, sort of physics common sense in some really significant ways. And then it turned out to be, you know, true. I'm putting up quote marks for you, George, because I know you think you can't really say anything completely true. But so I think he must have been conditioned by that success in his own career to think, superstrings, very odd, but mathematically very, very compelling, and therefore they will
as were quarks, and as was quantum chromodynamics.
Yeah.
It's just like beautiful theories and so beautiful that they had to be true, and then it turns out that they could find verification. And so you can see how that would, I mean, I think it's true for a lot of physicists who are really enthusiastic about superstring theory, and yet there's that frustration too, because there's, you know, this really seems no conceivable way to really test it. I mean, I guess there's been some proposals for like very indirect ways to test implications, and of course we've talked before, gotten into the whole landscape thing and the idea that, you know, you have to change sort of how you look at science from, you know, just looking at a possible ensemble or an ensemble of every possible universe and then coming up with a theory that would imply to the ensemble without being able to prove it, because you're just stuck in one of the little universes, and then it becomes very metaphysical.
And we're in this universe because if the universe was different, it wouldn't allow for our existence.
Yeah. Yeah, there may be another universe where someone's doing something, you know, equivalent, you know, involving entirely different energy and matter and coming up with the same puzzlement. Mm-hmm. But it's great stuff. I love it. But I really like that piece you wrote, kind of going back and describing your history of becoming a skeptic about grand theories. And I hadn't realized it started all the way back when you were at IEEE Spectrum and you'd written what you described as a very enthusiastic puff piece about this person who had done this. Why don't you tell the story about the paralyzed young woman?
Well, this was sort of a side effect of moving from Cold Spring to Hoboken. So I have these two gigantic filing cabinets that are filled with stuff that goes back to when I started my career in the very early 80s. And I decided that I just couldn't keep all that. And so I culled the files. And in doing that, I went through every single file that I'd kept for all those decades, and sort of rediscovered a bunch of shit from earlier in my career. And one of the files was on this guy, Jerry Petrovsky, who was an electrical engineer, who in the early 80s claimed to be able to make paralyzed people walk by attaching electrodes to their muscles, let's say if they're paralyzed below the waist, and then delivering these computer-controlled pulses to the muscles through these external electrodes and activating the muscles. And this guy got a lot of attention. He was on 60 Minutes a couple of times, got national media. There was even a TV movie made about him starring the actor Judge Hirsch as Petrovsky. Oh, and so yeah. I originally did a puff piece. Petrovsky was a star of this Society for Electrical Engineers that I was working for in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. This is my first job out of journalism school. So I wrote a puff piece about the guy because his research seemed amazing to me. And then I got some letters from other engineers who said, this guy is not doing what he claims to be doing. You should really be looking at his work more closely. Mm. And I did that, and I found out that, Petrovsky was misrepresenting his research, and that this one particularly dramatic event that was broadcast by 60 Minutes, which involved a paraplegic young student getting her diploma, walking up to the podium to receive her diploma because Petrovsky's machine allowed her to do this, that hadn't really happened, that the machine actually malfunctioned and Petrovsky and this other guy were kind of dragging her to the podium. And so I wrote this piece revealing all these problems with Petrovsky's work. And as a result, the IEEE initiated an investigation of me instead of Petrovsky.
You.
And so actually, my career was in danger. I was threatened with being fired at that point. And fortunately, I my piece held up, and Petrovsky ended up leaving his university, which is Wright State in Ohio. And it kind of, looking back, that was the beginning of my turn from being a kind of celebratory science journalist to being much more critical, skeptical, doubtful of the things that scientists said to me.
Yeah.
And I've just been thinking about that a lot lately because we're starting this science communication program at Stevens, and I often worry that I'm too critical and kind of mean-spirited and, skeptical and focus too much on the negative in science. And I have to say, going back through all my files makes me think that in some ways, if anything, I'm not skeptical enough of scientists. If I look at the history of theories of the mind and even some of the wacky theories in physics that have been proposed, and so many have come and gone, and yet each new one comes along and we get all excited and hopeful.
Yeah.
But I do think I love celebratory science journalism when it's really well done by someone by Carl Zimmer or Natalie Inger or you for that matter, George. And so I'm trying to figure out what sort of values to convey to students.
There's plenty, there's no shortage of things either celebrating or maybe not quite celebrating, but just describing some great new discovery without, any effort to really look behind it and to see, to see if it, how shaky it might be. I mean, there's usually the obligatory things where you talk to a few other colleagues when the paper comes out who were in the field but weren't connected with the research, and some of them are skeptical and some of them are not. But as far as like really, digging in and doing some very skeptical take on something, I was thinking of Lee Smolin's book about superstring theory, mm-hmm. which of course is by another physicist, or the one that Peter Voigt did. Yeah, not even wrong. And
right. Yeah, you know, science is so powerful, and science is so, I mean, it's our best way of knowing how the world works.
Yeah, I mean, it's the only way. I mean, that's it's not like we're going to intuit these things through some kind of mysticism or something, but
And so I think it's really, you know, science has about as much credibility as any institution can have.
oh, well, yeah. I mean, it's the only way. It's just, yeah, like anything else, there's mistakes and imperfections and false starts, and in a lot of them, just because, driven by people's enthusiasm with wanting to find out how the universe works, and there's got to be a limit to what it's possible for the human brain to understand. And the fact that we push up against these limits and do our best to exceed them, to me, is pretty inspiring. But it's also easy for things to result in a lot of misunderstanding among non-scientists, like our readers, about what's true and what's not true in science. Like, I was at a dinner party this weekend, and someone was asked me very seriously if scientists took Rupert Sheldrake's theories seriously about the morphogenetic field. You know, this idea that there's this non-physical field surrounding the Earth in which everyone is connected, and this all kind of grew out of a talk about how everything's actually really connected, and we're all part of this great mystical web, and I'm kind of, sitting here thinking, where's this going? And there are like two or three people at this table, very, very, very smart people in other fields, but who had all these ideas that things had been established by science beyond doubt. And one of them was morphogenetic fields. Another one was Russell Targ's remote viewing experiments. We've talked about those for the CIA and ESP experiments. And this one young woman was saying how, well, yes, there's this well-known phenomenon where like several scientists at the same time will come up with the same idea. And I said, well, yeah, that's very true. Like with Murray Gell-Mann, he came up with the idea for quarks, and almost simultaneously, George Zweig came up with what he called aces. And it was, basically the same theory. And then and Gell-Mann came up with his eightfold way of organizing the subatomic particles. And almost simultaneously, Yuval Naaman, this Israeli physicist, came up with the same scheme. But of course, he didn't call it the eightfold way. And Naaman would have actually beat Murray into print and gotten priority, except that his paper was bounced because it wasn't double spaced and he had to have it redone. But all these things happened was because the ideas were in the air. Everyone was thinking about what they called SU3 symmetry and group theory in Lie algebras, and everyone was examining these things with this idea they held some clue to explaining order in the subatomic hodgepodge of particles, and it was just a matter of time before one and probably others would lit upon the idea. It had nothing to do with mystical morphogenetic fields, but she was insistent. There'd been all these cases where there'd been no contact whatsoever between the scientists, and maybe not physical contact, but everyone reads the same journals in a field. They go to the same conferences. These ideas are in the air, but no, I mean, scientists have proven this, and ESP's been proven, and well, I said, well, why then don't we read about this all the time? And aren't there these companies making lots of money exploiting it? And it's because it's been suppressed. And well, why would anyone suppress it when a discovery like that would be worth 10 Nobel Prizes? And
Oh God, I've had those conversations so often, and my student with my students, as well as very well educated adults. I just have to mention, and I notice we're like an
oh, 10
hour.
minutes over at least.
Yeah, but I just got an invitation to the what is it? It's the conference, the big conference on consciousness that's held in Tucson, Arizona.
Oh, yeah, I got one of those too.
Did you see who the speakers are?
I don't think I looked that far. Okay. I mean, this is Stuart Hameroff's conference,
yeah.
Right?
Okay, so it's Stuart Hameroff. So there is kind of the quantum theories of consciousness, as well as more conventional theories.
Right.
Christoph Koch is going to be there. He was at the very first one back in the early 90s, which I went to and reported on for Scientific American. That very first one was funny because there were also some really wacky kind of new agey people there. And now, but they were sort of on the fringes of the conference. Now that's become institutionalized. So one of the, I think he's a plenary speaker, is Deepak Chopra.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
So, you know, your friends are actually justified in being a little confused about what counts as real science.
Well, yeah, that's true. And even with something, you know, far more legitimate than Deepak Chopra, you know, people will tell you like, oh, yeah, I was just reading about how there's 10 dimensions of space.
Yes, right.
I said, well, not maybe, you know,
yeah.
But it's like as though it were established. And even if the stories, the science stories, you know, have all the qualifications unusually, I would say.
Yep.
And, you know, and put this in the context of writing about a speculative theory. But that part all gets kind of, you know, jettisoned along the side, and these little memes go through. And then maybe the 10 dimensions of space have something to do with morphogenetic fields and...
It
reminds me of that book I reviewed for the Times a few years ago called How the Hippies Saved Physics.
Right.
You know, got into that whole thing with Jack Sarfati and all those interesting people.
Yeah. Well, there's still a lot of imagination in science, thank God.
That's good.
All right, George, I think we're
going to wrap it up. Well, if I don't talk to you before January, some weird thing beeping in my office. I think it's a battery burned out on a smoke detector. But anyway, have a Merry Christmas.
Same to you.
And maybe sometime around New Year's we can do this again and kind of pick up our pace a little.
I'd like that, George. It's great to talk to you.
You too, John.
All right. Talk later.
Okay, bye.
Bye.